This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Robert O'Reilly. My name is Gowron. Honor to you and your house. You're listening to Trek FM.
T.O. Greyhawk.
Welcome to another episode of Earl Grey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to the next generation. I'm the chorus of your host, Amy Nelson, and joined with me today are Richard Marquez and Justin Oser.
Well, my chorus was just killed by the Salayan, so I, Amy Nelson, am back here speaking. And Richard, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Who's going to clean this mess up?
Well, they totally got disintegrated, so there's no mess here.
There's some ashes right there. Right?
Oh, yeah. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm sad now. We've started with the tragedy.
Oh, well, there's much to be learned from every tragedy, and I think that we will see that as we go through today's episode, which is Loud as a Whisper. Now, before we get going, we do have some fan response from our last episode, Earl Grey 209, where we talked about Admiral Nechayev. Unfortunately, I wasn't on this one. We had Brandy Jackala join us for that. And there was some great response from the Babel Conference. Christopher Bacchus said, speaking about Picard's decision in Iborg, it's a shame we really didn't get to follow up to it. Dissent sort of reset the Borg, so Picard's decision had no great impact. His decision could have had a worse impact on the Borg than just shutting their computer systems down with a math problem. Hey now, math problems are always good. It would have been interesting to see either decision not work out like they thought, having the math problem failing and leading into first contact, since the Borg would see the Federation as a bigger threat than they first determined. If they went with Picard's plan, seeing the Borg fractured as they try and deal with the ships doing their own thing would have made things interesting on Voyager. Of course, it would have changed the story for first contact. Well, thank you, Christopher. Some things to think about. And it would have been interesting to see both situations take place.
Definitely. I mean, and also this episode generated quite a lot of response, particularly about Picard's decision with Hugh in Iborg. So we can't read all of that. So you have to go to the Babel Conference to see all of that. But we do have a few more samplings of that feedback. So listener Grace Lillianne Alexandra Archell Thompson, hope I got all that right, said, just got round to this one, and it's funny because I was just having a conversation with a friend today about moral choices and the needs of the many outweighing the few, but not necessarily being the right choice, only the easy one when presented with a dilemma. However, with the Picard-Borg decision, I think of it from the point of view that the Borg are such a high danger to the galaxy, tied in with those people under Borg control being both slaves and unable to regain quality of life back, even if breaking away from the Borg in many cases. Couldn't it be considered the humane thing to do, euthanizing them, rather than considering it destruction of life by destroying the Borg? Yeah, thank you for that comment. There was a lot of thought-provoking conversation about this one, wasn't there?
Yeah, definitely. And I sort of thought the same thing of, you know, that these Borg are slaves and wouldn't it be the humane thing to do to destroy them? Because it's not like they are, you know, regenerating or not that they are you know, I don't know, having Borg babies, they are assimilating others.
You're assimilating others, yeah.
You know, and so that assimilation is taking away others' freedoms. And so is it really a species like that?
It's,
I don't know.
It's tough when you talk about them as slaves, though, because, you know, in history, we would want to have the policy that there's nothing to be done and no redemption that's possible. But in this case with the Borg, I think it's kind of a could be considered a special circumstance, right?
So Eric Bogan says, this was a very interesting episode for me. I actually always thought of Nechayev as a bad Merl until I listened to these perspectives. As a major DS9 fan, I rewatched the Maquis many more times than any of her other appearances, so I've always perceived her as disconnected from what actually is going on and not willing to listen to any of her subordinates' input, just like so many of the other admirals who appear in DS9. I had forgotten how sympathetic she was to Picard's positions in Journey's End. I also guess her appearance in The Search didn't do much for my perception of her either. Looking forward to rewatching some of her TNG appearances.
I'm so glad to hear that's getting someone to rewatch some of those episodes and see the character in a different light. I think that's one of the things we definitely wanted to do.
Joey Slotinsky? I hope that's correct. I apologize if I butchered your last name. I love Admiral Nechayev. She's one of my favorite admirals, and I never had a bad impression of her. I always thought she was a tough cookie who knew how to get the job done, and that's how she had ascended to her and importance. I appreciate when I saw Captain Picard actually make an effort to have the same relationship with her that he seemed to have with all of the other admirals in the fleet. Good thoughts, guys.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for all the feedback.
Yep, it was a very good episode. Sorry I missed it, but Brandy did a stellar job filling in for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I am so excited to do this episode review on Loud as a Whisper. It's just one of my favorites. And when I hear people say, oh, I don't like season 1 or season 2, this episode always pops in my head. And I'm like, how can you not like the seasons? Now, I know a season isn't just one episode, but I feel that this episode has so many themes threaded out that it really needs a good discussion. So that's what we're going to do. But Justin, why don't you give us a brief synopsis of the episode so our listeners know what episode we're actually talking about?
Sure. So here's Memory Alpha's very brief synopsis. The Enterprise brings a deaf negotiator to mediate the end of a planetary civil war. I think it's about
Justin.
Well, we agreed last time so that I wouldn't make a mistake like saying Duras was worse father that we go from Memory Alpha for the synopsis. But no, it is definitely about more than that. Probably if I were to give a synopsis myself, I mean, it's kind of hard because there's a lot of kind of abstract concepts about peace and negotiation and disability and all of the. It's kind of hard to give, you know, a summary of the episode. But like, if you were to give a summary, what would it be, Amy?
Well, I would say this is the one where we have the deaf mediator to come and get these two warring factions together. And I think that would be good enough because people, I would hope, would remember the deaf mediator.
Yeah, and I guess you could add that in the midst of it, he has this chorus that interprets for him, the chorus dies, and he has to adjust to that. That's kind of the other part of it.
Yeah. So this idea of the chorus is so interesting to me. I mean, because when Reva explains it, he has these three people. And without it, we see that he explains that the chorus is not just speaking for him, but it's revealing his emotion of his words. And so when Data actually learns the sign language and is speaking for Reva, like Data's speaking the words, but he's not giving the emotion. And so that's missing as well. And when I was going to university, my minor was communications. And when I was in middle school as teaching, I developed and taught a communication course for middle school. And I used this clip of the chorus and how he was introducing the chorus to launch one of my lessons in hopes to have this discussion with my kids and how they use intonation to, you know, convey your emotion, that it's not just words. And Reva explains that there are these three voices. The first one is the scholar, and that is the speaks for the intellect, the judge, the philosopher, and also the dreamer, artist, and poet. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting for this first one to have so much importance, because I wouldn't think to put the intellect, the judge, the philosopher with the dreamer, artist, and poet. Does that make sense to you guys? Why do you think that they put those attributes into one person?
It's a good question, because, you know, before really thinking about the breakdown of all of the things that are included, I tend to, as a shorthand, think of the scholar as logic and passion, which is the next one as emotion. But, you know, there can be a lot of emotion that is associated with being a dreamer, an artist, or a poet. So it's, but it's interesting to talk about it as the scholar, because we might usually think of a scholar as someone who studies something and is very, you know, serious about their studies. I mean, an artist and poet can, you know, study certain things, but we think of them kind of separately. I'm not sure. I mean, what do you think, Richard, about combining all that stuff together?
Actually, I think it makes sense. Each one of those characteristics deal with original thought, and you need to have you know, some kind. You got to have intellect in order to have it. But, like, I mean, each one of them creates it on their own, or it creates it within yourself. And I guess you have to have some kind of a basis of like an original thought in order to even dream, create art, be a poet, judge, and also philosopher, and then I guess intellect will go with all three, with all four or five of them. So that's how I'm seeing it. Why they were all combined is because they need an actual original thought in order to do any of them.
Yeah, so. I really like that, because when I look at being a philosopher, you are studying, you know, society and this idea of thought, which then takes you to the next step of being a dreamer, this artist and poet. So, I like that. Good job, Richard. Well, the second person that was introduced to us is Passion. He's the romantic lover and warrior. And for me, this makes perfect sense. Like love and hate, those extremes, those emotions, that passion just combines so well together.
But if the other one's about original thought, would that mean, you know, romantic lover warrior tends to be just from like a certain template of behavior, not as much original thought?
Right. Well, probably a reaction to that, to whatever's being said or done. Like I would ask, I would probably add in their anger as well, but yeah. I guess anger is, it could be, you know, coupled in with warrior. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, well, like we were talking, original thought, this would be original emotion, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I could see that.
And then the third one is harmony, and that is wisdom and balance. So combining them all together. And interesting that the first two were depicted as male and harmony is female. Thoughts on that?
I don't know if that would fly today. I mean, given that a lot of people want to be, there's no stereotype that men are always, you know, the scholar or, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, and being the society that we are now, that everyone has to be included on everything, that would not fly today.
Yeah, I wonder if. If you were to redo the episode, if you might actually like expand it somehow to four and make two of them male, two of them female, something like that. But I mean, having the scholar as someone who's male, that's a stereotype. But having Passion as someone who's male, maybe so also, because I think in certain parts of the script, he's referred to as like Adonis. So it's like this male ideal of passion. But yeah, it's an interesting choice that I hadn't really thought too much about.
Yeah, there's definitely some gender roles that are being displayed here, and we're not going to go too much into it. I just found it interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think nowadays you could, the sex of the chorus wouldn't really matter because you've got women who are just as passionate, women who are just as scholar, men who show and display harmony. So I think the gender roles nowadays is more equal right now. Well, if this was your chorus, which one would you be using the most? Like maybe give us a percentage, like think about in your life. And listeners, I would be interested to know for you, like what percentage would these three chorus be speaking for you? Justin?
Well,
how much scholar passion and harmony do you use in your daily life?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I would say that for the scholar that tends to be, you know, a good percentage. Are you asking me to have like exact percentages?
Well,
estimate.
That was just the math teacher in me. Yeah, that just seemed easy to.
Well,
for me.
I mean, I guess if I were to really think about it, it would probably be something like the scholar would be 40%, the harmony would be 40%, and the passion would be like 20%. Because I feel like that passion part is expressed just in like certain parts of my life. And in most of my life when I'm, you know, at my job or doing a podcast or something, I'm kind of taking advantage of the other parts of it. But like balance and harmony are really important for me, and that's why I'd put it as just important as the scholar. So,
Richard, how about you?
I don't know. 100% harmony. No. No. I'd say, I don't know. I'd probably be on the same line as Justin, but mine would be 40% scholar, but it would be a lot higher with passion than it is harmony. But then again, there's that wisdom piece to it. So, I don't know. 40 for scholar. Probably 40 for passion, because I think they're pretty much equal, and then the rest is harmony. Way to go for my math.
Add it up to 100. We can do
this.
Well,
20. There you go.
And since you've asked us, what about you, Amy?
Well, as I was looking at this and, you know, thinking of this question myself, I think that as I get older, my harmony is speaking more because I've learned to temper the passion and the scholar. I think sometimes in my life, especially while I spend so much time as a teacher, and so like I have my teacher voice, and that definitely is the scholar. And I try to get that dreamer and expose the beauty of math to my students. So I think that the scholar for me is where I speak the most. And definitely the passion is the least, because I think for me that tends to make me more vulnerable when you're showing that much emotion. So I would have to say 50% scholar, 40% harmony, and 10% passion.
Interesting.
Aww. Yeah. Yeah, so
you get enough more.
See, but if you're talking about like in your daily life, though, like think about how much time you might spend, like, you know, at work or doing tasks where this, you know, like passion of romance and love and warrior and libido and all of that might get in the way of what you're doing, right?
Well, but I mean, passion doesn't necessarily have to involve, you know, sex or libido or anything
exactly.
Like that. It could be passion for. It very well could be 60% passion for Amy because she loves to do math work or what, you
teaching,
know, teaching math. Yeah, teaching, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
But like teaching math, and that, I mean, obviously that can fluctuate. I mean, it can't be static. I mean, it'll fluctuate depending on the situation too.
But I think there's a difference between how we might think of passion, like passion for an interest like math or Star Trek and how it's portrayed in the episode. Because in the episode, like this passion part of the chorus specifically says, I am passion, the libido, the anarchy of lust, the romantic and the lover. I am also the warrior, the perfect line which never wavers. So that at least the way it's described there for this character, it's very much on that, that, you know, spectrum of like, you know, love and romance, right?
Well, yeah. And that's where I think like that raw emotion, you know, where you're completely overtaken with this feeling, whether it is for love, passion, you know, war, anger, stuff like that. So to me, for me in my life, that I try to suppress. I'm more the logical, I'm more Vulcan that way.
I see.
For me.
Yeah.
So.
All right, moving along.
All right. Well, I just wanted to touch on this real quickly. So it was interesting because he explains that his chorus, you know, it has been used. His ancestors have used it. He was born deaf and he hopes to remain deaf. But his chorus is being used for his purposes. And I know the episode doesn't really go into it, but isn't that sort of like slavery? I mean, there's been this other, and I say quote unquote, symbiotic relationships in the Federation. A couple I was thinking of, well, the one that really came out to me was in Enterprise season 2, episode 22, Cogenitor, where they're using this third party to have their children, right? Do you remember that episode?
Yeah. And I think on the outline, you mentioned the Trill, which is even more symbiotic. They kind of live together in that symbiosis all the time. Well, all the time after they're joined.
Yeah. And so how do we feel about these other people being used for your or for his purposes? Like, how do we feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think in this case, you know, one of the things that that they talk about is that Reva is part of this ruling line, and they talk about, you know, other ruling lines. I think like they talk about the Hanovers on Earth that had hemophilia and it was, you know, genetic. And apparently for him, it's genetic that he doesn't have the ability to hear sound. So it seems like he is part of some like ruling class or some kind of royalty almost. And these are like his servants that serve him. So I don't think it's any different than, you know, when you have a monarchy and there are servants that basically have their livelihood provided by providing services. Now, we could argue whether they're a part of that of their own free will, but we don't know much about this circumstance, how it develops. Is it like they're groomed for that in their childhood? And how do they know how to interpret for him? They must be telepathic in some way and connected into what's happening in his mind. So how does that develop? When does it? I don't think we know enough to really kind of understand it more and put a judgment on it. But I think it does seem like their life is pretty much all about like serving him and his needs, right? So they're like his servants.
And that's questionable.
Yeah.
Either that, he's rich as hell and, you know, he's paying them pretty good money. I don't know. You know, I was just thinking about this. It's like, you know, reading over this outline, I was like thinking, it's like, you know, honestly, if this was like a true utopian and that we're going the direction that what's going on in medical science and all that kind of stuff, this wouldn't exist. But yeah.
Well, I don't know if Reva and his society are part of the Federation or outside of it and using their services for negotiation.
I don't know.
Yeah, it just comes into play. Like, I would like to know that the chorus had their own choice and free will and wanted to serve Reva that way and not being forced to. I guess that's what so many times.
Yeah. I mean, that would be good. That would be good to know. Although, like, based on what we can see in the episode, it seems like they're fairly happy in doing what they're doing. But we don't really get to know much about them as people when Reva's not there.
Yeah, definitely. So. Well, another very important theme of this episode is conflict. I mean, obviously, Reva is the best mediator and is known to be so. He says he's very confident, actually, and says that he's never not been successful. And the Solaians chose him, and Reva is the only one that they were willing to speak with. Now, when he goes to the conference room with Picard, and they want to give him the details on why the conflict started, and Reva's like, it doesn't matter why it started. They've been fighting for 15 centuries, so the original dispute is no longer relevant. And then he asks, what is the new piece of the puzzle? Why do they want peace now? Like, something had to have happened where they wanted to have peace. And it was interesting, like, you know, Riker was like, well, maybe they're running out of people to kill, you mm-hmm. know? And, you know, Data didn't really have an explanation for it. So I thought that was very interesting. And like, have you been in a conflict where the original reason is no longer the cause?
Actually, Amy, before we get into that, I want to go back a little bit to what Reva was saying, because I think it's important for this discussion. So the scholar speaking for him says that the specific issues don't have relevance. And, you know, Riker is asking why that's the case. And he's saying through the scholar that, you know, the information will indicate the conflict is over a piece of land or wealth or some other tangible asset. But we both know that is not the case. And Riker comes to an understanding they've been at war for so long it has become personal. And then the scholar says exactly the basis for peace must also be personal. And I think that's something really interesting when you think about conflicts that go on for a while, that it's really not about the issues at all. It's something that's personal. So if that's true, then if we're thinking about like a conflict where the original reason is no longer the cause, then it has become something that's more personal, I would think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So what, you know, has there been, well, I'll start, because when I was thinking of this, not that I think, okay, let me start over. So as I was thinking about this, I sometimes become the mediator in teaching as a teacher, and sometimes have to mediate between students and parents. And you know, when students have been failing for so long and the parents just have no idea what to do, it's like, well, it doesn't matter what was done in the past, because we just need to start with where we are right now. And if the student wants to be successful, the parents want to be successful. And so we sort of start from that ground. There was a time, specifically in my family, my sister, my nephew, he was almost ready to flunk out of high school. He was not being successful. He wasn't doing anything to any of his homework or anything. And he just had all these excuses of why he wasn't doing it. And I just sort of came in and we had a little powwow, my sister and her husband, my nephew and me. And we just like, okay, where can we start right now? You know, and not saying that it was me, but they both decided to come together to try and create this harmony, because it was not doing so well in the household and stuff. But I think that coming at that, you know, of it doesn't matter why my nephew was being unsuccessful. We just needed to have a starting point and to move forward from there.
Well, I guess I had a different kind of example. Because, you know, I haven't talked about this too much here, but I've had some difficulty with my parents over the years. And I actually don't really talk to them at this point because of some things that happened. But it feels like, you know, if I look at it from this perspective, that there were some original conflicts or things that happened. And eventually when that break happens, it is something that's very personal. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to see you. It becomes very personal. And the kind of reasons for getting to that point get kind of lost over time. And yeah. Ends up becoming something that's more personal. So that's what I think about. And if there were to be, you know, some kind of change, that they would have to be, you know, a personal kind of interaction or change as well. So I think there's actually a lot of wisdom in what's said in just those few lines for how these things work. Richard, unburden yourself.
Unburdened myself? Where do I start? The psychiatrist charges 15 cents a minute. I get it. I don't know. The original reason is no longer the cause. I'm in the same boat as you, Justin, with my own parents. But I think so obviously I had lots of troubles with my parents right before I left for the military, and it continued over for various reasons, and even getting out of the military was pretty hard to even get along with them. And yeah, I was in the same boat as you. I didn't really talk to them for a very long time, actually, and or at least communication was sporadic. And I think what changed all that was that I had my daughter. And even though that her mom and I are no longer together and whatnot, it's one of the things that I've always taught my daughter is that you need to have open communication with your family. And now cousins, uncles, okay, you know, you necessarily have to keep up with that, but at least talk to your grandparents and your parents and then your brothers and sisters. And at that time when I said that, and this was when she was like 4 or 5, I was a hypocrite because I didn't talk to anyone. Family, I mean, my sister, both my brothers, or actually all three of my brothers, and even my parents. So, and funny enough, I think that lesson came from Star Trek. Actually, come to think of it, I can't remember where I remember that from. I mean, because like there's a lot of things I tell her that are from Star Trek. Lo and behold, we're on a podcast. But like one of the things that I told her was that, you know, you need to make sure you keep those relationships open because you don't want to burn those bridges down just in case you do need help later in the future. Whether that be me, your mom, your sister, or well, not sister, future siblings, not saying anything. But like, and then same thing with your grandparents and your closest cousins and all that kind of stuff. And that's ultimately the lesson. And ever since then, the relation, even though there are some things that it really irritates me about my dad and my mom and everyone in my family, I've still managed to find a way to find a common ground to make peace with them. And for the sake of Eva and my future children and also my new wife, to create that bond and family. So I felt it was very important to mend those relationships because my daughter, I mean, needs a family here in Colorado, and the rest of her family's in California. So I can't alienate my daughter like that from family. So, yeah. But yeah, original cause was not, I mean, the original reason was not, it was definitely not the cause now, but I've tried and learned to get around that.
Yeah.
Has it gone completely gone away, but it for the most part it has. So
where now it's functioning and yeah.
I don't know about functioning.
Well, yes,
semi.
They were there at your wedding. I met them.
Yes, that's true. That is very true. Yep.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite all-time quotes, I've almost had this like put up in my classroom, is when after the chorus was killed and Reva sort of goes into his loss, and this is where Counselor Deanna Troi is going to step up and say, well, I'm going to give it a try before we leave because, you know, it's too important. And she goes to Reva and says, hey, what's the trick? What do you do? How are you such a good mediator? And, you know, Reva explains, well, it's not really anything. It's just, you know, you have to turn a disadvantage into an advantage. And then Troi spins that right around and says, why can't you do that? Why can't you turn this disadvantage into advantage? I totally love that. She so clinches it right there and makes Reva think about, well, yeah, why don't I do it? I just think it's so funny because like you say the words, but then when they're given back to you, it's like, oh, that's what it means. Anyways, I love that. So I just made me thinking about, you know, like when you're, how do you make lemonade when given lemons? Like how, I know it's so difficult, but how do you turn a disadvantage into an advantage?
I think it's a really tough thing because like when I remember when I first saw this episode and the chorus was killed, I thought, like, how are they going to move forward and make this work? And up to the point where they were talking about turning a disadvantage into an advantage, I didn't quite know where that was going. But then when you see what he does in the end with taking the time to teach them sign language because he no longer has his chorus, it's brilliant. It's like this amazing breakthrough that I never would have thought of myself. So I actually have a lot of difficulty with that. If I had like a big disadvantage, turning that into an advantage. I mean, and in this case, turns it into something that probably has more of a chance of success than his traditional approach in this one. It's brilliant. I mean, and every time I see it, I love it. And I was definitely surprised the first time I saw it, how they resolved it. It was just so satisfying.
Well, and plus, like, he's going through some serious loss. I mean, mm-hmm. he loses his chorus. Not only is it his ability to communicate, but as he says, they were my friends, and that he never really understood how much they meant to him until they are gone. And I just think, yeah, when you're in such a painful place in your heart and he just wants to retreat, he doesn't want to do anything, he doesn't want to be mediator anymore, like to have that switch is just so, it is, it's what makes the episode so great, is having that realization of how he can use that and teach them sign language and have them come, the Salaeans come together and build that bridge through his loss.
Yeah, I mean, Richard, have you had something in your life where you've had to turn disadvantage into an advantage?
I don't know. To be quite, I mean, the first thought I thought was Iraq, but I was like, no, that's not really a disadvantage. It's more like survival. but like, I don't know, to be quite honest. I mean, I can't really say, I'd have to think on it a little bit more longer. Cause to be quite honest, one of the things that I always try to do whenever I come up with, I mean, especially like in work, I guess I could use work as an example. One of the things that I do, it's because I'm a senior at my job, and sometimes we get hard-headed people coming out of the military or out of the civilian workforce or whatnot, and sometimes the way the process works in the what we do and everything is that you have to follow these regulations pretty much by the number. For the most part, there are very few gray areas where you have to go outside of that. And one of the things recently is that I had a guy that wanted to go outside those lines, and trying to find and eventually we found. I mean, after a while we butted heads, but eventually we found common ground that he wants to do the veteran right, which I agree with. I totally agree with. But we gotta go through the proper channels. And finally, actually, he's one of my, I don't want to say favorite. He's one of my best workers out there. And you know, there was a point in time where we absolutely hated each other. Mm. And then we finally both figured it out on the same grounds that we're trying to help the veteran, help me, help you, sort of thing. And it eventually changed. Wow. Finally, after a couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, all I can say is I'd have to think about it more to come up with a good example, because it is a little tough to think about that. But do you have like an example from your own life, Amy?
Well, when I was thinking about this, yes, I do have an example. So I've always wanted to have kids, but it never happened, in part because I didn't want to be a single parent. And so with that sort of guiding and then not getting married and stuff, it's like, okay, well, here is this disadvantage of never becoming a mother. And so turning that into an advantage, I just, I think I just more had to change my frame of mind and thoughts about it to turn that into an advantage where, you know, I can be the favorite aunt. I can, you know, with being single, I get to travel and do things that a lot of, you know, parents don't get to do. Like, there's experiences in life and you're not going to be able to experience everything. And so I've just sort of accepted that, well, I'm not going to experience that, but look at all the other experiences that I get to do in this life and to treasure those and to, you know, make my lemonade out of those experiences and not really cry over the ones that I don't have. Because there's going to be times, I think, in everyone's life, because you're not going to be able to, you know, do everything. So I think that's sort of how I've turned it into an advantage, just more along of changing my thought process on that.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. I actually thought of something while you were talking, actually.
Good.
So about 5 years ago, I'd been working for a company for about 7 years and doing some customer service and sales, and the company got sold, so I was going to lose my job within a couple months. And, you know, I kind of looked around and I couldn't really find, you know, any kind of job, but we were getting, you know, like a severance package. And, you know, I talked about it with my wife and we just kind of decided, okay, maybe we should do something a little bit different. So we were living in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area at the time. And we decided, I'd always wanted to move to the Northwest, that we would just move to Washington State. We actually moved to this small town where we didn't really know anybody, just to kind of see what the experience would be like and hoping to maybe set up a business there, just something like that was a break that would be a little bit different. And during that time, as it happened, you know, I did have someone that I worked with at the previous company, and they had moved on to another company and, you know, happened to offer me an opportunity. And that's, and I'm not sure if I would have taken advantage of that kind of thing, which has been really like good for me in the last 5 years and like having a different career and doing something different, if I hadn't taken that break and actually moved somewhere else as like a clean break and doing something different. So that kind of disadvantage of, you know, losing my job and just having a certain amount of savings going somewhere else because we just needed a break and it was something different seemed to be a disadvantage, but it was actually an advantage for doing what I've come to do over the last 4 or 5 years. So, yeah.
Yeah. That is a great example. Oh my gosh.
And it was a big risk too, because we only had a certain amount of money that was going to, you know, run out after a couple months.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, a subplot. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, where did you go? What city in or what town in Washington?
The tiniest town in the smallest, most rural county in the state. It was a little town called Cathlamet, which had like 1,000 people, in this tiny county that's in the southwest of Washington on the Columbia River. But it was such a beautiful area, and it was something that was so inspirational just to be there, even though we were only there for a short time before we had to move, about 6 months. But it was also interesting living in a real small town, which I hadn't done before, and the kind of things that you see in a small town, the camaraderie and the trust and all of that. It was kind of helpful also in having a break and moving forward to something different. So yeah, but a tiny town you've never been to and never heard of, which is such an interesting experience.
Yeah, and especially coming from the Bay Area where there's tons of people.
Yeah, millions of people, tons of traffic. It was a very, right. Very different experience, but it was very rewarding to move from that to something else, as much as I had enjoyed being in the Bay Area for like 15 years before that.
A subplot of this episode talks about disability, and when Reva meets Jordy for the first time, he asks about his visor, and they both agree that their disability makes up who they are and wouldn't change it. And I just love how Star Trek rejoices in diversity and recognizes not a disability, but a difference, and how we are to appreciate the differences that make each of us special. It's interesting to note the actor who plays Reva, Howie Seago, he's deaf, and he approached the show's producers with the idea of a deaf mediator. The initial idea came from his wife, who's a Star Trek fan. The writers originally wanted Seago's character to learn to speak after his course is killed, but Seiko was opposed to the idea as it could perpetuate the practice of forcing deaf children to speak. The producers were understanding of his concerns and wrote a new draft, which is why we see the Silaeans learning sign language instead of Reva learning to speak. Now, when I heard that, I was like, wow, I did not know this. I knew Reva, the actor, he was deaf and stuff, but I didn't know that it had come from this whole idea came from him and initially from his wife.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it is, I think, as you mentioned before, one of those things that elevates it from a good to a great episode. And it would have been, I think, disappointing if it was just like, oh, he learns how to speak and he can get past that. But it's a much more transformative thing to, again, to talk about turning the disadvantage into an advantage instead of just kind of trying to change and be the same as others might be. And I think I saw also that he was glad that he was in this production, because if it was somebody who was not like actually deaf, they might not have said something to try to change the direction of it. But yeah, I mean, it's a great story and made this episode so much better and so much, have so much more of an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now the part with Jordy, I wanted to say something about that.
Go for it.
Like in rewatching this in the context of the episode, the part with Jordy seems to be way a little bit out of place, because Pulaski, I think maybe you're talking about the scene with Pulaski where she's saying, oh, we can, you know, have something to replace your visor. You'll have almost the same vision. You won't have all this pain you've been experiencing. And I think they put that in there because LeVar Burton at some point wanted to be able to, you know, show his eyes, which happened much later. But it seems a little weird to plant it in there. And as I was thinking about it, I was trying to make a connection. I mean, because he has this disability. And when LaForge meets with Reva, they really understand each other. And he's the only one that kind of reciprocates the gesture and puts his hand on Reva's chest, like Reva puts his hand on, you know, Riker's chest and all that. So, I mean, it does point up talking about disability and whether it makes sense to do something to kind of navigate around that. But I mean, do you see it, Amy, as like reinforcing some of the themes in the episode? Because when I see it, it's a little bit jarring. Like that scene with Pulaski seems a little unrelated.
Oh, I thought it fit in nicely because, you know, we see Reva and his deafness, but he, you know, wouldn't change it. Well, he couldn't change it, as we learn later from Pulaski. But I think that there is this theme that we see throughout the series with Jordy and his eyes and his disability. And, you know, when he's down on with the Romulan and is like, well, you wouldn't even be born because we would have killed you because you have this disability you can't see. And so I think it just sort of sets up this whole idea throughout the entire series that, you know, Jordy has been given an option to have regular vision. I mean, Pulaski has done it twice before that we learn. And so he sort of ponders it and yet chooses not to have his eyes changed or his sight given regular sight because of what he sees now through his visor. I think it fits in perfectly with this episode. Richard, what do you think?
I do too. I mean, ultimately, she's trying to fix it, or Pulaski's trying to fix a disability that Jordy is, in a sense, you know, he's thinking about it in the beginning, and basically at the end, he's saying, no, I want to keep it the way it is, after, I'm sure, talking to Reva. That motivation to, you know, I'm happy with who I am, and this is who I am, and if I change it, then it ruins or possibly even destroys my identity. So, yeah, I think that's a very important piece to have that in there, that, yeah, to not, you know, be happy with who you are, I guess.
Yeah. But what changes with how he feels here, which is in, like, the second season, and then by the time we get to First Contact, he does have ocular implants? Like, what's changed in his thinking by then?
I don't think that's any change. I think those ocular implants did not replace his eyes to regular vision. I think the ocular implants are exactly what he sees with the visor. Oh. It's just now they're internal instead of external. I don't think, well, as we know, his eyesight is not what we see. It is still getting all the EM waves and whatever, you know, he's still seeing through his visor.
Spectrum apparently with his visor. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what his ocular implants do.
And in first contact, he could zoom in.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that, that it might do the same thing as the visor, but just be a different like.
No, it's tool. Exactly the same thing. It doesn't, because Pulaski was giving him a chance to have regular eyes.
To regenerate his optic nerve, right? Something like that, yeah.
The visor and the ocular implants do not do that. It is still getting all the spectrum and stuff.
I'll take that. I don't know if we had that much of an explanation like in first contact about it, but I think it makes sense.
Wouldn't you think that would be standard issue to have a visor? Because, I mean, if you can see everything, why wouldn't everyone have
that? But I mean, they talk about in here that Jordy has pain because of it, and he has to learn how to filter through all of it.
No, I know, I get that, but I'm just saying, like an actual visor, like to take someone on an away mission or something like that, you could see everything and be like, oh, kind okay, of like, yeah, you won't miss anything.
Like a heads-up display you have now, that kind of thing.
Right, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like night vision goggles and just, okay, I'm going to put on the visor so I can see.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Like a tricorder. Or even thermals or something like that. Yeah.
That makes some sense. They didn't know about that in like 1989. Yeah. Interesting.
All right. So after this discussion, why don't you give us your final thoughts, Justin, on Loud as a Whisper?
Well, I think, as I said before, this is one of my favorite episodes. I think there's a lot of really great wisdom and a lot of great things to think about. And usually when I think about this episode, I think about negotiating peace and trying to get past conflict, dealing with loss. And of course, turning disadvantage into advantage, I think, is one of the most profound things that's in here. But I like the way that you structure this, Amy, because at first when, you know, we thought about this episode and you wanted to talk about it, I thought it would just be, you know, we just talk through the different parts of it kind of free form. But I like that you're asking us questions about it, about the episode and about our personal experience, because, you know, it's clear one of the lessons in the episode is that if there is to be conflict resolution, because conflicts tend to become personal over time, the basis for peace needs to become personal. So it's kind of like the basis for this discussion needs to be personal as well. And I really appreciate that.
Richard, what did you think of this episode?
Oh, what did I think about this episode? Well,
do you like the episode?
I didn't.
Okay. Fair enough.
Mean, before this episode, I actually did not like it. It's not one of my favorites. I mean, it's definitely in my top 178 of TNG.
Oh,
jeez.
Oh.
No, but how do you feel about it now?
Oh, okay. No, I just got to get there.
Okay.
But like, thinking about it in a way that. You know, talking about how we perceive things and whatnot, and this disability and whatnot. I actually kind of like it. Well, I'm warming up to it. How about let's just say that.
And is it at least in your top 50%?
Like I said, the top 178.
Okay.
It'd probably be in the top 50. I'll give you that. But I mean, it's definitely one of those episodes that I'm like. I skip over it, but like thinking about it in more detail, in the sense of turning a disadvantage into an advantage, sure is a great moral to this story. So I'm warming up to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, this is one of my favorite episodes, especially for season two, and again because it's a Troy-centered episode because she really. Does it for me there.
And the episode ends with Picard saying to her, thank you, well done.
I know. And the smile on her face is just, you can tell she's blushing and she's appreciative of Picard recognizing her contributions to this mission. And so, of course, we love it. I love it for that. But I really love the themes and the idea of communicating and how do you communicate. Again, it's not just through your words, you know, because if I send a text or an email, like you can't hear my intonation, you can't hear the meaning behind it, and you can interpret it any way that you want. But when I speak it with my, you know, emotion and my intonation, like, you understand me better. That's why face-to-face communication is so much better. So I just love the idea of communication. And again, conflict resolution, like you talked on, it's just, there's so many awesome, good themes within this episode that just to me really radiates that this is a Star Trek episode. This is what Trek is to me. And so that's why I wanted to discuss it.
Excellent. Well, it's also one of my favorites. So it's, you managed to mask for most of the episode that it's not one you really like, Richard. But that's the beauty of how you did the discussion, Amy. It's, in a certain way, it didn't matter what you thought of the episode. It was more reflecting on personal experience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally.
Well, it's been fun talking about Loud as a Whisper, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here's what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
It's sort of what she did with Picard and just said, I'm looking at the entire expanse of your career decisions, and these decisions, you've broken the Prime Directive. And so looking at this mass, it sort of brought it back to conspiracy, where it's like, yeah, you're going to find something and there may be excuses for it, but what's the pattern overall? I thought was an interesting twist that she did against Picard.
Warp 5.
The reason why I'm surprised by this is because you don't see a lot of asexual reproduction in higher order life forms, because sexual reproduction allows for genetic diversity, whereas, again, asexual reproduction dictates genetically identical individuals.
The 602 Club.
What happened last season and the things that start to happen this season is, you know, Jay comes in and tells them about the danger from or two with Zoom and everything. You can see the weight that it's having on this person. And I thought that that's just really good writing. Like, you know, that you can't stay that same kind of person that he was in the beginning here. And they're going to do some things throughout the season that are going to help Barry kind of overcome that, or at least try to overcome that. But at the beginning, I really felt like that the writing was very strong, specifically for the character of Barry and everything he'd been through in that first season and now into the second season.
Literary Treks.
Yeah, that's definitely the case, I think, for sure. Well, in this novel, it's very much about the Klingons and their society. And it's from the perspective, there's a framing story, basically, in which Captain Kirk starts reading a book called The Final Reflection, which is told from the perspective of the Klingons. And it's ostensibly the book that we are reading here. This is the book that Kirk's reading in this book.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review.
If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up.
If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Earl Grey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So Amy, where can people find you when you're not serving as part of Riva's Chorus?
Well, you can find me here on the network. I'm hosting Postcards from the Edge, which is now going for our Star Trek Discovery podcast, where I talk about the fan response of each episode. You can find me on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson, but my favorite place is right here on the Babel Conference. Richard, where can people contact you when you're not cosplaying as Worf?
Nowhere, because I don't stop. Well, they can find me on Facebook. I'm also on the Babel Conference, where I pop in here and there. And I'm also on Twitter. My handle is Eric's Ransom, where I have yet to share anything yet with my dog. It's all on Instagram. So, anyway. So, Justin, where can people contact you when you're not negotiating peace treaties?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. I am currently continuing tweeting out my rewatch of season 4 of TNG. And I tweet about Discovery a lot, especially now that it's coming back on for the second half of season 1. And you can also find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope that you'll join the team. Again, you'll find the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to take this opportunity to recognize our current associate producers. They are Norman Lau, Justin Ozer, and Michael Huter. Thank you so much for supporting Trek FM and Earl Grey. Well, join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
Things are only impossible until they're not.
Today is a good day to die!
Great joy and gratitude.